This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I have known that the danger of the nuclear power plant, but I had not active enough to stop it. I like to apologize that this has happened, and the radiation has been diffusing to the world still now.
And this is one of Peter Sandman's holy grails, is that if you're not talking about worst-case scenarios, you're not doing a very good job of communicating.
But the people in Tokyo, more than 200 kilometers away, are essentially walking on radioactive waste every day.
Fukushima, 1 year later. I'm Alex Smith. On the anniversary of the world's worst nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan, I am taking you with me to a heartbreaking conference organized by physicians to assess the ongoing damage. You will hear the latest from nuclear engineer Arnold Gunderson, just back from Japan. He'll tell us about continuing dangers, spreading waste throughout the country, and radiation in North America from trees to seafood. More important still, two Japanese activists tell us how citizens in Fukushima Prefecture are coping, how, in the face of organized denial by governments and universities, they're acting to protect their children. This story goes well beyond the meltdown of three reactors still out of control in Japan. Listen closely, and you hear how governments fail their citizens in emergencies, how they lied after the Chernobyl and Three Mile Island nuclear accidents, and they lied after Fukushima, and why you must be prepared to organize your local community when any kind of disaster strikes. Whether it's a hurricane like Katrina, big floods or tornadoes, governments cannot and will not save us. This conference was in Vancouver, March 11, 2012. The Fukushima nuclear disaster 1 year later was organized by Physicians for Global Survival, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, Simon Fraser University, and other medical organizations in British Columbia. It was recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's start with the clearest, most honest voice right from the start of the Fukushima disaster, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds.com. You are about to hear a keynote speech from the conference, The Fukushima Nuclear Disaster, 1 year later. The speaker is Arnold Gunderson from the consulting firm Fairwinds. His topic is the Fukushima disaster and its aftermath and comparisons to Chernobyl. This was recorded March 11, 2012, in Vancouver, Canada, by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock.
Our next speaker has been waiting patiently. Mr. Arnie Gunderson is the co-author of the first edition of the United States Department of Energy's Decommissioning Handbook. He has had over 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience, and at one point he was coordinator for projects in more than 17 nuclear power plants in the United States. He's come from the dark side. His colleague, friend and wife, Maggie Gunderson, is also with him, part of the Fairwinds Associates, which provides information and consultation on nuclear power and nuclear radiation in the United States and, as of today, Canada. Please welcome Arnie Gunderson.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it. I wish I could be there in person, but this is the next best thing to being there. Today, I wanted to talk about the Fukushima Daiichi disaster and compare it to Chernobyl to try to give you as physicians an idea about how the two disasters compare. Just about to this moment, 1 year ago, I was confident that the Fukushima reactors were in a meltdown. Now, that doesn't mean I'm clairvoyant. I'm sure when I look at the NRC transcripts, that the NRC knew as well that a meltdown was occurring just about this time. That's not what they told us, though. So I'd like to open today with a suggestion that we all take a moment and honor several thousand very brave men and women at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, as well as the Fukushima Danai plant. Both of them almost had meltdowns, and of course, three units at Fukushima did. But were it not for those several thousand people, Japan would be cut in half, and the nation of Japan would no longer exist. And likely, certainly Vancouver and the West Coast would be very, very contaminated as well. So I think we all owe a debt to those several thousand people who risked their lives today and for the next week or two, a year ago, to save the plant, to save the nation, and likely to save the world. I also wanted to thank just briefly the translators for the Fairwinds website, as well as the Fairwinds team led by my wife, Maggie, who is the brains behind this outfit. Now let's get on to the topic at hand. It was pretty clear that the Mark I containment had a long, long history of problems. Those problems include a containment that was too small, it's been known for 40 years, hold-down straps that were added after the fact because engineers thought the forces would be down and it turned out they were up, venting of the containment because of hydrogen buildup, which engineers never, ever anticipated. As a result of all this, Maggie and I were walking about 3 weeks before the accident, and Maggie said, you know, where do you think will be the next nuclear accident? And I told her, I don't know where, but I do know it's going to be in a Mark I containment. And of course, the Fukushima reactors were a Mark I containment. So there was that piece, the technical piece. But then in addition, there was the geologic piece. And also, for 20 years at least, serious scientists in Japan knew that the tsunami risks were being underestimated by the Japanese government. Even 8 days before the accident, Tokyo Electric was convincing the Japanese government that there really wasn't a tsunami risk and they needed to study it more rather than build the seawall higher. So this wasn't an accident. This was an accident waiting to happen for at least 20 years and likely 40 years. It's interesting because in the heat of the battle, one day into the accident, someone on an NRC conference call blurted out, this is the worst containment in the world. So while the NRC has been telling people for years that this containment is just fine, when push came to shove on the day of the accident, they clearly knew otherwise. The accident started with an earthquake, and there's the myth of a safe shutdown. When a nuclear plant shuts down, it really doesn't shut down. 95% of the heat goes away when the control rods drop in, but 5% remains. And that's because the nuclear fission is stopped, but all of the fission products, all of the pieces of uranium remain radioactive, and that's the problem. Even when the reactor stops, the heat does not stop. So for a plant like Fukushima 2, that's about 200,000 to 300,000 horsepower that has to be gotten rid of in a room about the size of a small bedroom. I think you can imagine the heat problem. Well, when the earthquake occurred before the tsunami, clearly there was already a problem in Unit 1 because radiation levels were increasing inside the building and at the fence posts, even before the tsunami hit. The tsunami. Well, when the tsunami hit, I'm sure you've all heard that the diesels were flooded and they were unable to get electricity into the large pumps required. We call that loss of off-site power and then a station blackout. Engineers thought a blackout would occur maybe last for 2 or 3 hours, and they put batteries in that lasted as many as 4 or 5, 6 hours. Well, the batteries began to fail also. So by this time a year ago, I knew the batteries were failing, and that meant that a meltdown was inevitable. When the fuel begins to get hot, the fuel rods begin to crack, and that lets out noble gases. And if you remember, noble gases don't react with anything. So at least 3 nuclear cores worth of noble gases were released within, certainly within 12 hours of the accident beginning. As the fuel gets hotter still, the zirconium clad begins to ignite. It burns in water. It strips the hydrogen away from the oxygen atoms and becomes zinc oxide, creating hydrogen. Well, that hydrogen gas builds up, and the containment fills with hydrogen gas. It was never designed for this. At this point, clearly heroic efforts of the staff were required. The valves that were designed to vent this containment couldn't be opened because they needed electricity. And men went into high radiation areas in the dark and opened valves to begin to relieve the pressure. They were not completely successful. The pressure in the containment began to increase, and what that means is that the containment began to leak, not just through the vents that the men tried to open, but literally the bolts that hold the containment together began to grow with the pressure and release hydrogen into the surrounding buildings. At that point, all it took was a spark to ignite the buildings. Slide 7 shows Unit 1 exploding. It was less than the speed of sound. That occurred on the first day. That was a hydrogen explosion because the containment didn't contain. Slide 8 shows Unit 3 exploding, a dramatically greater explosion that literally went up as high as 3,000 meters, and the speed was much faster, and the building is totally destroyed. Slide 9 shows what appears to be an intact building at Unit 2, except you'll notice the box in the front of the building with steam coming out. That shows that there was an explosion internal to the building. While the building is intact, the containment was breached. That steam should not be coming out the side of the building. So we have three containments that were breached from internal explosion. Slide 10 shows Unit 4. Unit 4 had no fuel in the nuclear reactor. It was all removed into the spent fuel pool and is, in fact, the most dangerous of the four on site. It blew up, and there's lots of competing theories about why, but the key is it blew up. This is the reason that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told the Americans within 50 miles or 80 kilometers to evacuate. The nuclear fuel in this reactor, Unit 4, didn't have any containment around it. And if it were to burn, Brookhaven National Laboratories has estimated that 186,000 people would die of cancer relatively quickly after the building caught fire. This is the building today that could still cut Japan in half if there's a major seismic event. There's several lessons technically that we can learn from the first week or two of the accident. The first is the inadequate design bases. And what that means is that as engineers and scientists, we didn't anticipate the worst that Mother Nature could throw at a plant. The next one is seismic problems. Unit 1 failed before the tsunami got there. That's an indication that seismic analyses need to be modified. The next one is loss of an offsite power. And together with loss of the ultimate heat sink, those two occurred when the tsunami hit, the diesels were flooded, and more importantly, and this is not even discussed yet, and should be because it affects the Canadian reactors as well as reactors worldwide, the pumps along the ocean that cool the diesels and that cool the nuclear reactor were destroyed. So even if the diesels had survived, there was no way to keep the core cool. It's called loss of ultimate heat sink. Here in the States, the NRC is studying it, hasn't done anything about it, but it is the most serious global issue relating to this incident. We all know that the Mark I containment was inadequate and that venting was also inadequate. Well, I wanted to use most of this presentation's time to compare Chernobyl's releases to Fukushima's releases. It was clear to me that on the second day of the accident, Fukushima was as bad as or worse than Chernobyl. We call that a level 7, which is as high as the scale goes. Now, there's some differences. The Chernobyl release was a single reactor, and it lasted for less than 2 weeks. The Fukushima release was 10 nuclear reactor cores. Now, what do I mean by that? We had three nuclear reactors that were operating, and we had about seven nuclear reactor cores in their spent fuel pools. So 10 nuclear reactor cores potentially could release radioactivity into the environment. Chernobyl stopped releasing after about 2 weeks. And of course, now we're a year into the Fukushima accident, and it is still releasing radioactive material. Well, the key for this accident, the Chernobyl accident, and also Three Mile Island, is that no one measured the releases. At Three Mile Island, all of the radiation detectors were designed only to detect low-level radiation, and they were destroyed during the accident because the radiation levels were so high. At Chernobyl, the explosion exceeded what the instrumentation was capable of, and also, of course, the radiation went out beyond where the instrumentation was. And at Fukushima, the electricity that powers the radiation monitors failed. So no one knows on an hour-to-hour or minute-to-minute basis what Fukushima released. But the releases come in four different categories. There's noble gases. The noble gases were released for sure when the fuel began to crack. This is 2 or 3 to 12 hours after the accident. Now, if you remember your chemistry, noble gases don't react with anything. This is xenon and krypton. You'll also remember that xenon is used medicinally. I think xenon-133 is used as a radioisotope. It's fat-soluble and absorbed in your body. Now, we know for sure that 3-5 times Chernobyl's releases of noble gases definitely have been measured. There's good scientific papers that show that from the noble gases, 3 to 5 times Chernobyl were released. To the northeast of the reactor, we know that the noble gas concentrations were something on the order of 1,000 disintegrations per second in a cubic meter of air. Well, the next one is iodine. There are lots of questions about how much iodine was released because iodine does react chemically with the components in the building. But we're certain that iodine was picked up worldwide from the event, and even nuclear reactors here in the States were picking it up within several days of the beginning of the accident. The plant released iodine. The question is how much, and I'll get to that later. I'm sure you've also seen cesium numbers. That's the easiest isotope to measure. It doesn't mean there's not many other isotopes present, but the cesium concentrations in the soil are the easiest ones to measure. And lastly, you have heavy isotopes like plutonium, and those have also been detected as far as 50 kilometers away from the reactor. Now, one definite similarity between Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima is the fact that there have been government cover-ups of the radiation that's been released. At Chernobyl, researchers were intimidated and, in fact, arrested and thrown in jail for as long as 3 to 5 years because they tried to investigate the releases. I have friends who've tried to go into Belarus even now, and they're refused access when they realize that their purpose is to research the accident. At Chernobyl, we know the demographic data was missing and, in some cases, deliberately destroyed. At Three Mile Island, we know that the demographic data was never applied. As a matter of fact, the federal judge on the case limited the scientific analysis and told the researchers that if they came up with too high a number, she wasn't going to believe it. So we've got definite government cover-ups at Chernobyl, and I refer you to an excellent book called Chernobyl, Consequences of a Catastrophe. And it's by Alexei Yablokov and others, and it was published by the New York Academy of Sciences. It used to be on sale for $150 a copy, but because many people are very interested in getting the book out, the cost has been reduced to $15. It's an excellent piece of work, hundreds of pages of peer-reviewed analysis. And if you can't find it on the web for something on the order of $15, if you contact Fairwinds on the contact page, we can get you copies or get you in touch with one. So we're also aware that the Japanese are attempting to minimize the consequences of the accident as well. So government reaction to all three accidents has been to minimize the consequences and also try to marginalize the scientists who are doing the work. So how bad was the Fukushima accident? The secret is in the assumptions. Everybody can do the math. But the question is, what assumptions went into the math? And the key is in the assumptions. So what really are the public health consequences? There's about a half a dozen different assumptions that need to be factored in. And when I watch the industry, as they have been over the last 5 or 6 days, it's clear that they are trying to minimize each and every one of these assumptions. First assumption is, how much radiation was available to be released? Well, as I've already said, there was 3 operating reactors compared to 1 at Chernobyl. Plus, we had 7 nuclear reactor cores in fuel pools that were uncooled as well. So potentially, there's as much as 10 nuclear reactor cores available to be released. What were the timings of the release? Chernobyl failed almost immediately, but it was only at 7% power when it did fail. Fukushima units 1, 2, and 3 failed in 12 to 36 hours, but they were running at 100% power when the accident occurred. So releases could be significantly larger from Fukushima. Pretty convincingly determined that 3 to 5 times Chernobyl gases were released as noble gases. And so therefore that tells us that essentially every piece of fuel failed inside of the 3 operating reactors. And perhaps additional fuel failed in the fuel pools. What was the timing of the releases? No one knows because there was no radiation detectors present. But again, this is a number that's subject to assumption. If you assume the predominant releases occurred when the wind was blowing inland, you'll get one number. If you assume the wind was when the wind blows out to sea, you'll get another number. So the timing of the releases in coordination with the meteorology can produce in dramatically different calculations of the exposure to people within Japan. The next one down, decontamination. What that means is that there's water underneath a nuclear reactor. And for the last 20 years, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has assumed that 99% of the cesium gets trapped in that water. Well, there's a problem there because after Fukushima, that water boiled because it had no cooling water, getting back to the loss of the ultimate heat sink I talked about earlier. The NRC has also said that if the water boils, no cesium will be held up in the water and all of it is subject to be released. So the question is, what are the various people calculating doses assuming for the decontamination factor for cesium? I've seen the Japanese assume that 99% was retained. There's an Australian study out, though, that shows that 90% was retained. That doesn't sound like a lot. It's, in fact, 10 times more cesium the Australians are assuming than are the Japanese. So what that number is a critical piece of analysis that I found that the nuclear industry and the Japanese are consistently trying to downplay. What was the meteorology like on the day of the event? If there's good news in the Fukushima disaster, and I don't think good news and disaster really belong together, but if there's good news, it's that most of the time the wind was blowing out to sea. Now, at Chernobyl, the reactor was surrounded by people, and surrounded by farmland, and surrounded by cities. Here, at least half of the compass was the ocean. And this accident would have cut Japan in half already were it not for the fact that the wind was blowing out to sea. Now, there's other pieces too. Of course, the Fukushima prefecture has mountains immediately to the west. And those mountains prevented a lot of radiation from reaching the west coast of Japan. But now we've got contaminated forests that can essentially never be decontaminated. In the next several months, you're going to hear about contaminated cedar. And as the pollen is released this year from the cedar trees, we'll have an enormous amount of cesium being revolatilized into the atmosphere. So the Fukushima accident isn't over. The cesium is being re-released by Mother Nature. Also, the cesium is being washed into rivers. And the rivers, of course, are heading toward the ocean. But we're seeing contamination in freshwater fish as well as ocean fish as a result of all the runoff through the mountain ranges in the Fukushima prefecture. We're also seeing large cesium deposits in the bottom soil on the bottom of riverbeds. And of course, that gets picked up by weeds and seaweed in the ocean that then get eaten by other fish and mollusks and work their way up the food chain. So we're seeing cesium concentrate in riverbeds, and this is not a problem that's going to go away in the next year. We're looking at a long-term problem of cesium contamination. I was in Tokyo 2 weeks ago, and I just randomly picked five sample locations as I was in the city and put them in bags, brought them back, cleared them through customs, and sent them to the lab. And each one of those bags has contamination levels of dirt that would be qualified as nuclear waste and buried in Texas here in the United States. But the people in Tokyo, more than 200 kilometers away, are essentially walking on radioactive waste every day. So as doctors, you've got a public health issue throughout northern Japan from this chronic exposure to low-level radiation. And then you've got a personal health issue for the people in Fukushima Prefecture who have been exposed to well over 10 from the accident. So which was worse, the Fukushima accident or the Chernobyl accident? They were both awful. I noticed that in reading Mikhail Gorbachev's memoirs, he credits Chernobyl, not Perestroika, but Chernobyl, with causing the downfall of the Soviet Union. And of course, I'm sure you've also heard in the last 2 weeks that Tokyo was almost evacuated as a result of the Fukushima accident. Even today, if there's a significant earthquake and one of the fuel pools collapses at Fukushima, Japan still could be cut in half. So which is worse? I go back to the first line. They were both awful. We're talking about a technology that has the capability to destroy a nation. There's a long-term cleanup effort that's going to be required by the Japanese. I don't believe the Japanese have recognized the severity of the problem yet. They seem to be nickel-diming it and spending, you know, a billion here and a billion there. But in fact, the total cost of this cleanup is now estimated to be $500 billion. That's a half a trillion dollars U.S. to clean up the site and the surrounding prefectures. Now, nuclear experts on television have been saying, well, the accident was bad, but we're never going to find any injuries. I disagree. When I look at the use of their assumptions, I can find error after error that make them non-conservative.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a presentation by nuclear engineer Arnold Gunderson at the Vancouver Conference, The Fukushima Nuclear Disaster, 1 year later. When we return, Gunderson explains his predictions of a million Fukushima cancers in Japan and takes questions from this well-informed audience. Then you hear straight from Fukushima. Leaders of citizens acting to protect their lives and their children. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock.